Accession number 27226, reel 27.
Reel 27.
Yeah. Well, I was a bit of a dog's body, and this was one of the exercises that we did as par for the course. We might have, I can't remember just off the top of my head if we'd had any gunnery offshoots, but it's unlikely, I think. My flying, I can't be specific about the flying, but I think really of the next one was the thinking of the floating dock. A bit of history here, because one of the problems that the Navy had was the fact that the war was moving back east again, and in order that ships, especially the big ones, were properly serviced, they had to come back into dock at some time, and the only docks that were available for the eastern aspect of the war were Durban, China Bay, Sydney, somewhere else, Durban, Sydney. What really say Durban and Sydney gives an indication, and they're a long way away if you want to go back out of operations to have a boiler clean or a bottom scrape or the general service of a large ship. And so they decided in their wisdom that they ought to have a floating dock in Ceylon, and they had one built in Bombay. And this came on a stream a little time before I went to China Bay, and was brought down, and that was part of the problem relating to the sinking of the Cade of Ishmael, because it was a slow drag with a big floating dock all the way from Bombay down to China Bay, and they put quite a lot of defence behind it just to make certain that it got to where it was going. And it was important because a big one, there was Admiral Floating Dock AD 23, I think it was, but it's in the book somewhere. And they did the check with two ships, and again my memory is getting a bit crook, but they did a couple of ships, and it worked very well. And then they put the they'd done the primary tests and with a couple of ships, and then they put the Valiant into the floating dock, which we had seen arrive in China Bay, but it was just another piece of kit, not of very particular importance. And it came in, did the tests, and then they finally did another one. They put the Valiant on board and drained it all out to do whatever they had to do with the Valiant. And it was set into the Valiant was inside, and then they lifted wanted to lift the dock out of the water, and the dock master, I understand, got his knickers in a twist or something, and one of the pumps failed. And when the dock was going up, it slipped, and they couldn't stop it in time. The whole ship, whole dock became imbalanced. And one thing that did happen that I didn't know about was that one of the guns on the Valiant turned sideways when it was slipping and went through the side of the dock. But we have the Valiant there, which is quite an important piece of kit for the war. There was a cruiser which were going out of fashion anyway. But they lifted it up, and it slipped sideways, and then one of the guns went through the side of the dock, and then the tail end went down, and Valiant was still partially afloat inside the dock. as it was coming up, and it went back through the back open gates of the dock, knocked the two into the water, and the floating dock, it bashed up all the tail end of the Valiant, and the floating dock just sank, plop, and it left a floating dock sitting on the bottom of China Bay with all its cranes sticking out of the water. And that was the first thing I saw of this monster which was there. And later on, about six cranes or eight cranes sticking out of the water and nothing else. And that in itself was an experience. I didn't see, it go down, but we looked at this piece of kit and looked at the story afterwards, and that was a disaster of major proportions. Now, at that time, the war in Burma was still on the boundaries of India and Chittagong, and the war had not started to move away, but the Japs had started to pull out at that time, which becomes part of the next part of the story, actually. And so, fortunately, it didn't matter anymore because the war itself had moved in a different direction. But if it hadn't, and the Japanese hadn't started to pull out of Burma, I wouldn't say pull out, but they were fighting out, then the whole tenor of the war would change completely, because the fleet would have to be serviced either in Sydney or Durban, and the floating dock was not there. And you can imagine a triangle of time and distance. So the sad thing that the Valiant was smashed, it couldn't sail anymore, it made quite a mess of itself, and it went back to England, and I think it was sold, it never sailed again, and it was sold in about 1950 as a scrap. And the floating dock stayed at the bottom there for years until after the war. And then I think the Sinhalese government purchased it and took it up and scrapped it for some way. But that's a singularly incident of which I was aware of, had no part in at all. But the implication, the overall implications, people don't know it. You know, it's not known. It's something that went by default, not reported on at any time. So that's one of the things that happened. Flying was... they lost my papers, of course. That's why I was still at China Bay. And that was Jack Dyson. And ultimately, they couldn't find a relief for Jack. And my relief came. I can't think of... not very clear. Though China Bay was quite an interesting place. We had a South African CO. And one of the jobs I was doing there, because... again, I was a dog's body, was to do things. I always wanted to do things. And I think after flying, I think a corollary of flying that long trip, it sort of did something in my mind that people are going to fall in the water. And we'd never done it properly, but nobody had ever thought to put in proper safety kit with the dinghies on Avengers. And did a whole, as part of my exercise, I made all the Avengers fail safe if they fell into the water by making certain that the safety kit was something that nobody had done before. Things like making provision for if they were in the water, what to do, and if they were in land, if they were flying over the tropics. And so I made a pack for... or of air safety kit, I can't remember the phraseology now, but it was safety anyway. And we had a book there, a little book used to circulate amongst all the RAF personnel, Pilot Officer Prune. And there was a book, the Pilot Officer Prune Safety, of what to do if you were chopped down in the jungle, how you could live, how you could survive, with all the clues and all the guidance. And the things that they needed as well, like matches, cigarettes, were quite an important function, because if you were in a jungle, you, and I did a jungle course while I was there, by the way, as well. That probably corollary to this, that if you're in the jungle, leeches are a very big problem because they can get in through, you know, little eyelets in your holy shoe if they want to, and then they feed on you, and they can't get out. And they're full of blood and everything else. And the only way to get those off without getting septicemia or making the things go septic is to smoke a cigarette and put the touch on the bottom so they fall off. I mean, did you not know that? You knew that. Yeah. That was one of the things you learned. And in this particular context, we did a jungle course there, which was easy. But part of it was they sent there and told, well, there you are, get back. And you were no distance away from the airfield at all. And it was, with what you were taught and what you knew, it was easy. You knew what it was about. And you were given 2 days to get back. And one of the, an older goon, he was a lieutenant, he was an ex-Jersey Airways pilot. He was past his sell-by date. They put him in the jungle. And they didn't get back for 4 days. When he came back, he was no good at all. And he ended up just walking around, keeping the airfield clean of pieces of paper and things. And he was a mess. Purely and simply because he didn't know what to do, wouldn't take chances. Because you can live in a jungle and forever if you know what it's about. You know what to do, how to look after yourself with what little kit you've got. And
were
he came back.
Were you instructed on what things to eat?
Pardon?
Were you instructed on what things
yes,
to eat?
Yes, we had a book on the things that were edible in the jungle, the jungle book, which told you what you could eat and what you didn't eat. And I can't remember all the things now, but the point about survival, which you know, you get the best talk about that if you go to the SAS people, is that first of all, you've got to get water into your body. If you've got water, you can go a long, long time. And your stomach needs something to work on. And providing it's not poisonous, it doesn't matter, tell us, eat it. And because that, the body will take out from that and throw out the rest. So you need protein, and it's surprising what you can eat. I mean, there's beetles and bugs that you can eat. They're pretty awful to look at, but they have something inside them. It's hard to remember the detail now, but I wasn't bothered about if I found myself in the jungle. If I got into the jungle, then I was alive. That was half the battle. But then you had your parachute, you had all your gear, you could use the bits and pieces to make life comfortable for yourself. And, for instance, with a thing like an Avenger, you had a very big four sail dinghy. Well, if you go in the jungle with that, you take that with you because you're dry and warm forever. You know, these are the sort of little things. But in those situations when you're under stress, you don't think about these. But if you've gone through the exercise and done it all, then you suddenly realise that, you know, got to do this, that and the other. And an important aspect survival really is to not to let stress make you forget what you've been taught, if you've been taught it, and it means suddenly that instead of being in a desperate situation, it's a mental attitude really. You suddenly realise, Christ, I've got to survive, and you know what to do, what are the basics are, where are we, where are we going to go, what to do and what not to do, and if you're talking to people, what sort of people are you likely to find in villages and that sort of thing, because if you went in the Malaya jungle, for instance, you never knew whether they were for you or against you. And if there's civilization there, you're alive, but you didn't have to tell them you were there. You know, this is the sort of thing. I mean, they make the food, they don't chuck it all away. You know, you could creep in at night and get it. This sort of thing. Because until you knew whether they were friendly, you have a problem. You know? So that aspect is a story in itself in many ways. But it was a radical indication of what can happen if you don't do it right or don't look after yourself. He was covered in leeches. I mean, it was just... It was horrible. You know, he was a mess. and he went home.
Had he just not done anything or followed any of his training? Or
pardon?
Had he not followed any of the training that he'd been
I think he was just... he probably lost it when he found himself disadvantaged. I think that's the real thing. He got mentally disoriented and he didn't do the things he should have done. I mean, if he'd been taught the basics, he would have known what to do. But you see, it's difficult. You can imagine a situation. I've been it in civil life when in France, where I went into a forest because I wanted to just go through the forest, and you're lost and you're disoriented because you've no clouds, you've no sky, you've trees all the way around. You don't know which way is north, south, east, or west. And that is, first of all, the major disorientation. Where do I go and how do I get out? You know, and even that was in a jungle context, except we got paths. So if you could walk on a path, even in the jungle, if there's a village there, the villagers all walk down the same bloody route. You see one of those, you know there's life there. So that's sort of fundamental things. And if you're not taught them, or don't have them mentioned to you, don't recognise the problem until you're suddenly faced with it. And I tell you, it's not funny. I was going to catch a boat in France, and I was lost, and I finally got out of the place in the end, but I was miles away from where I should have been, in a village, and French people, and two girls told me where I was and took me all the way through the fields and through back home. But they don't do that for you in the jungle, you know. But it's interesting. And I suppose I've been for, what, nearly 2 years, living on the fringe of the jungle all the time. In West Africa, you see, we used to go into the bush to see the natives having their dances and all that sort of thing, because we heard the drums and we thought we're going to have a look. And so we were familiar with it. And that's quite, in many ways, quite important, because you're familiar with an environment. And you only got that by being on the ground. You see, if you're flying on airplanes and carrier, you don't see trees all the time.
It's interesting because you actually said about while you're at China Bay,
yeah,
a different problem as well. Partly, I don't know if it was related to the jungle, a different problem with different creatures there than there'd been at your previous airfield. Was it you said, oh, it's a different matter, something else there? Was it insects or snakes or something like that?
Now, the one thing I remember about China Bay came back from the fact that I didn't fly with, you know, go to the oxygen business. That because of the accident that happened in West Africa, we knew about that, my relief was killed, we all wore one piece white overalls made with cotton, you know, and just a jock strap only because it's so bloody hot. And when we came down from flying, we could wring that thing out. That's, again, that comes to the question of, did you drink any water? But you could wring it down, and you didn't wash it every day, and it stank. You know, it was sweat, and we used to take it off straight away when we got out of the aircraft and hang it over the tent line. We had tents there, and hanging over the tent lines to dry.
So conditions were still very hot and humid.
Oh, yes. I mean, the sun was shining, so it would dry the things out. And when you took them off, they were wet, you know. That's an aspect of the flying. And my recall, it was an interesting place, was China Bay, but my recall at the moment is not as good as it was. I can remember the main things. I went ashore. Oh yes, one of the things there, of course, we were very near to a social place. Of course, when we went there, the RAF had the airfield, and as far as the RAF were concerned, we were peasants, and we had no right to be anywhere at all. And this is another aspect of it. It's coming back now that we all lived. All our boys, the Fleet Air Arm lads, lived in bashers at the bottom end of the runway in the jungle. And this is where we talk about the animals and everything else, where this was, for instance, we still had the regular cabin situation made of fronds and everything else. And in there, you never knew what wildlife was going to be around. You go for a pee in the middle of the night, and you brush against something, and you think the boys had left a brush down, and it was a porcupine or something. It was walking up and down the alleyway, and just outside the huts, because we were in the bush, really, at the bottom end. There were snakes, rather a bit like Secundae, really, but not the same type. And they throw eggs to them, and they come and eat the eggs, you know. We could see them. We could, like, tame pets to have. We had that instance with the tennis racket and the crate, which was, when you saw these things, you got frightened, you know, because they're nasty little bastards. You don't want them wandering around, because they bite you. They were very poisonous. So that was down at the bottom, and of course, the RAF lived in a concrete palace up on the top of the bloody hill, and we weren't allowed in there at that time. At that stage, we did not enjoy the benefits of their messing. And in fact, I think of the 2.5 years away from home, I spent a bloody great part of my life living in tents, you know, and open air bashes like. In Africa, you know, but it was part of life, part of growing up, really. So China Bay is a little bit of a no-no in terms of quick memory.
But you could go ashore there, you said.
Ah, yes. Well, there were women there. That was a beautiful thing. And a girlfriend of mine I knew at Arbroath was now the Queen of all the... She was a two-ringer RN, RNVR. And I used to drive from China Bay to, presumably, Trincomalee. It was to wine and diner, because that was where civilization was. And the two incidents there that I set off one night to go and have a meal with her. In China Bay, and on the way it was raining. It was pretty horrible weather, and it short-circuited all the smoke floats round the harbour, set the whole lot off, shorted them, and I was driving a car in those conditions when you couldn't see, smells of chlorine. It was chlorinated, of course, and I didn't see my paramour, and I was lost on the road trying to find a place where to go. I wanted to get back, and I was on the way back, certainly, and I came across a Nissen hut. I thought, well, that's civilization. I went in there, and it was full of ratings, and I stayed there. I don't know what I did. But I remember that aspect of it, and I stayed there for a long time, and the whole place was just covered in all this fog, and it was unpleasant. It was, you know, chlorinated, and I stayed for a little while, and then I thought, well, it's getting a bit better. I'll go down the road and go back to base. And I went back to base, and I went into the wardroom there. That wasn't the main mess. Anyway, it doesn't matter, because I went into the place and Lord Louis was there, and he was talking to the CO, and he said to me, "What you'd like to have to drink?" Because I'd have a glass of milk, sir, please. And I got a glass of milk, and because I needed something to get rid of the chlorination. That smoke was appalling stuff, and. So I had that was my time with Lord Louis, and really it was flying and socialising. We used to swim a lot there at that in China Bay, and I always remember the personal sadness that I knew that I was going home, but I saw the whole fleet, the whole four carriers going out, the Vic, Illustrious, Indom, Indifat, I think, the four of them. Going out one day when I was swimming on the beach with this girlfriend of mine, and I saw it go out, and I thought, it's me done. I'll never, the war's over as far as I'm concerned, you know. I never got on a carrier, and never you know, do what I was supposed to do. So it was a bit of a traumatic thing, really. I remember it quite well. But we used to swim and, you know, do all the bits and pieces. I can't complain about my flying life. I mean, okay, we had some deaths and disasters, but we always managed to live and eat well. We had good food wherever we went. That must say, even with the stuff we'd had down at the camp at the bottom of China Bay. But then there was a sudden dramatic move. I don't know what happened. Because we've done the American thing, haven't we? That's when we were living at the bottom of the runway, and so after that, probably that was it. Because there must have been a decision somewhere along the line that they were running down the airfield from a flying point of view, except for the service personnel. Because obviously the Pelham Bang thing was a fiasco. The Navy had never done the Pelham Bang business at that time. And we moved it up into the mess, to the RAF mess, which was brick and it had a bar and all sorts of weird things. Like we had one of these leaf insects, you know? What do they call them? You can't, if you see them in a tree, they look like a leaf.
Stick insects.
And it used to come down onto the bar every night and sit in the bar. And we used to put liquor down, we used to drink stuff. And it'd go away and come back again the next day. Unbelievable thing. And you look at it, and it was like a branch of a tree. Quite incredible. Full of weirdos. Like, I spent most of my time in that mess. I remember listening to the radio and asleep. These are things that are coming back to me now, but it's, and the picture is not at all clear. Some mental pictures I have are quite pellucid, and not like China Bay. We went up to the mess there, and I was still sweating and waiting to go home. So I suppose I was just flying and tooling around. And then finally the day came. I don't know if there's anything else I can tell you about that. I've told you about the smoke and China Bay and the ships and the connections, the infrastructure there, and the fact that it was all really closing down. And I didn't realise it was closing down, of course. And finally, my relief arrived.